Hello and welcome to Earth Heart Network Radio, the land-to-mouth food farm and garden edition that comes your way live every week, now on Wednesdays instead of Tuesdays, so be aware of that. Happy to be with you here, Lisa Almaraz, and joining you on a beautiful spring day. We've got daffodils blooming, dandelions popping up everywhere, phlox rolling down the hills with pink waves of beauty all around us, trees blooming every single day. We've got more green leaves popping out all over as we get to watch the miraculous feat of nature, the slow and steady greening up of the mountains. We go from the seeming dead of winter to a radiant green that covers every hill and valley, every kind of biodiverse plant out there blooming once again, getting those leaves back. And of course, soon enough, all those trees will be flowering, which can be a big allergy time. But keep eating those great ferments. Keep your microbiome healthy in your gut. Stay well with wonderful organic food and watch those allergies diminish. I have worked on it in the 18 years that I've lived here in the mountains of Western North Carolina. And it's taken some effort. At first, I was absolutely flabbergasted by just how much I absolutely could not breathe around May or June when all of the trees flower that I did not grow up with. And over the years, I've learned how to work with homeopathics, little homeopathic remedies that do not suppress symptoms, but rather help our body get more able to effectively respond to the allergic histamine response that we're having. So it's great. Work on that. Work on it and enjoy the season more. It definitely would put a damper on my gardening out there in May and June when I couldn't even stop sneezing the whole time. So it's really great to do what you can to work with nature to heal your gut and heal your allergies. They can be healed. Yes, they can. Now, other things, we can't really make it something our body wants to deal with, and that's toxic chemicals, right? We have been blindly spewing millions of gallons of toxic chemicals of every kind, even using it on our food supply, right? And as Jane Goodall says, who could have ever thought it would be a good idea to put poison in our food supply, right? Well, it's not a good idea. We talk about trying to get those things banned, making efforts to have a more sustainable world. We're finding our water supplies are filled with all kinds of everything from pharmaceutical drugs to all these poisons. It's time to take our acres back, get things more organic out there, and just stop this blind destruction of life in the soil and life in our food through chemical agriculture. Of course, everything is made of chemicals, but unnatural chemical compounds are really costing us. You know, we look at the food in the store. Sometimes people say, oh, I can't afford organic food. It's so expensive. Well, doesn't it seem rather obvious there's a reason for that? You know, you have to pay a lot of money to get certified organic. It takes a lot of effort, but boy, you get subsidies to get poison food put out there. So wake up, right? Snap out of it. Stop eating that poison food because it isn't cheap. Because the cost is your actual life and your health. That's the biggest expense that there is, right? That's the one precious, priceless thing that you've got is your life and your relationship to the world around you. So this idea of poison food being cheap is really not the case, right? It's highly expensive. And for the first time, people are actually starting to put together some sense of quantifying just how damaging the costs of these chemicals are, both to human health and to our society. Now, truly, when you look at destroying the entire web of life in nature and chopping down entire rainforests and threatening life on Earth itself, really, because those are our oxygen-producing jungles and things like that, you look at this wanton destruction for some pitiful amount of money because somebody's greedy or some company is just determined to make money even if they're doing something really dastardly and awful to the planet. But we just keep going. And even after the climate meeting over there in Paris in November, we still have timber industries out there buying up forests, planning on logging millions of acres more of what is left of nature. And I feel rather urgent about it. I've felt rather urgent about it my whole life that we've really got to protect and preserve what is left. We have plundered enough in my 48 years on this planet. And of course, we've done this industrial view of conquering nature for a long time. Many societies that are wiped off the face of the earth now did it because of poor tillage, of doing things to destroy the topsoil, creating deserts, collapsed food supplies, monocultures, things that have been mismanaged. We've mismanaged our natural resources, and then those civilizations have collapsed. There's all kinds of ancient cities that are no longer here because they didn't handle the soil right. They tore it up and it blew away. And, you know, there was a joke I was reading about a farmer, and he went down to the market there, and he was in Texas, and he said, "Hey, my farm is for sale." And he was down in town, and he was talking to a gentleman there, and the gentleman said, "Oh, really? I'd be interested in seeing that farm." And a big wind kicked up, and the farmer said, "Well, there it goes by right now." Because you're losing topsoil. We've been losing topsoil disastrously for ever since we've been doing this large-scale unconscious agriculture, where we're basically destroying the soil, tilling it up, burning up the biology, as Ray Archuleta and many others have taught us. And we've got to be doing it differently, right? As Einstein says, we cannot do something the same way over and over and expect a different result. So we're here to be able to shine the light on sustainable agricultural models like regenerative ranching, organic no-till methods, working with cover crops, working with nature's own intelligence and the exudates that provide life and nutrients in a dynamic exchange with all plants and life there in the soil. And really turning away from the death spiral of all of these ecocidal industries that have just gone on committing basically crimes against nature and humanity for decades. It's time to really turn a corner on that. Do something differently. Choose life rather than death and fear, choosing life and love and stewardship together. So thank you for this great story by Common Dreams. Yes, Common Dreams is a wonderful website where you can actually get real news. That's kind of rare these days, right? We've got the inflated media trying to get ratings with a bunch of baloney stories just because they get people's attention. We won't mention the buffoon candidate that has been garnering all of the different ratings with atrocious behavior, right? It's all just a big circus when you get into mainstream media. Most of the time these days, very little substantial news going on. So people like CommonDreams.org and people like those at DemocracyNow.org actually doing real news, putting real information together. So thank you, Sarah Lazare, staff writer there at Common Dreams, talking about this story that was published on just a few weeks ago. Toxic chemicals costing society billions in damages to human health alone. And to me, that's the least of it, because the real damage that accumulates is in nature, in our water supply, in our soil, in our societies, and out there causing problems. So not only are the people living in the world being poisoned to a huge amount, but then we've got the whole world we're living in becoming this toxic swill of abused earth. So it's time to change that. And this story here talking about just how much it's really costing, just starting to even quantify the damages here. The good news is, in spite of all of this destruction and all of this greed-based business that has been very much a loss for everybody, you know, having a pile of money doesn't mean it's a good thing for the world, right? We've kind of lost sight of that with all the unethical business models we have out there, profit being king and not really having ethics, people just going bankrupt, starting another unethical company, doing it over and over. We can do it differently. The good news is, using cover crops, utilizing sustainable organic food production methods and models, everything from the home gardener to small-scale farming to large-scale farming is totally doable. It's much more effective. The food tastes better. The food is more nutrient dense. You can restore life in the soil. We're doing it at Living Web Farms, taking care to bring back the diverse microbial communities. We totally have the tools to do an entirely different, better model right now. And it's just getting out of the way. The lobbyists and the very, very corrupt forces out there that just want to keep poisoning the earth just for profit and for control of whatever. Not worth it, right? We have the new information. We have the new technology. We can do it much, much better. And why not, right? Why do we continue in that other way? Well, because we've got to know better. You know, I was shocked yesterday. I talked to a woman at a big box store that I had to go to for something I needed. And I was looking for something, and I was asking her if they had, which it had said on the website of the store, that they had a radiation shield protector for your phone, for a cell phone. And this lady was so ignorant, she had never even heard that cell phones emit microwave radiation. She didn't even know. And I told her, she goes, "Well, I've never heard of that." And I mean, I don't even know how to be that unaware, okay? I make an effort to be aware, and I try to share it with other people. And even if they're completely ignorant, I just try to be gentle and say, well, you ought to learn about it because, you know, your book with your phone tells you that it does do that, and that's why they give you the little headphone that's 3 feet long, because that's exactly the distance that makes them not liable if you got cancer. And people like her, they just have no idea. Oh, it's out there. Of course, it must be safe. And that's where we've just got to abandon that ignorant model of, oh, it's got to be fine. If everybody's doing it, oh, it's got to be fine. Let's just go along with the crowd. That's what we've got to stop doing. We've got to start thinking for ourselves, sharing with others in compassionate ways, and really being willing to make a new choice. You know, people die every day from habits that they refuse to change. And yes, we all die anyway, but living a better quality of life by making better choices is hugely powerful. I've had to make some big lifestyle choices just recently. I've got this midlife hormone thing going on, and I've had to be dealing with it, and I'm not going to go take pharmaceutical drugs or get surgery for it. So I'm doing it on my own with food and better lifestyle choices, and it hasn't been totally fun completely quitting coffee. I'll tell you, I've had the cravings, but I'm doing it. I'm doing it because I know I'll feel better and I'll have a better quality of life. And it's the same with these practices. We can do it differently. We can do it differently. We have the power to make a better choice. And, you know, it's ironic that I've got this midlife, you know, lady hormone perimenopause thing going on. But it really comes back into balance when you eat better food and you start looking to balance your hormones. And, you know, anybody and everybody who's out there subjected to all of these chemicals that are in our food supply, in our air, being sprayed on us from the sky, being, you know, emitted from the squishy plastic bottles. We've got all kinds of hormone disrupting chemicals for everybody. And they're found in these human-made products that we are propagating, you know, mountains of, from plastics to pesticides. Hormone imbalance is a problem for everybody right now. And if you haven't noticed, look around at the humans these days around all these chemicals. What do we have? Horrendous amounts of obesity, all kinds of really feminized looking, you know, men. And I'm not talking about people that choose to be transgender or feel that way and do that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about lots of extra fat and curves. And, you know, we've heard the term man boobs. You know, this is extra estrogenic compounds, synthetic estrogens out there, all kinds of hormone disruption. It's affecting everyone. It's affecting babies to old people. So now you don't have to wait for menopause to get hormonally disrupted. That's a bad joke. You know, the joke's on me, right? I've been dealing with it. But hormone disrupting chemicals are found in all of these products all over the world, and they're causing tons of health problems, costing society billions. But to me, the biggest real cost is endangering and poisoning our world, right? If we're letting all these toxins go washing down into the rivers and things, we're killing all the creatures that live there. You know, it's bad enough we've got destruction going on for ourselves. But then when we're wreaking havoc on nature around us, then how do we ever get back in balance, right? So we've got to protect and preserve our precious nature, the billions of quote-unquote costs in health of human sicknesses and diseases from this, to me, is just the tip of the iceberg. But it's not an insignificant tip. It's huge. Just published a few weeks ago in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. The examination was conducted by 18 researchers in 8 countries and is the first attempt to quantify the concrete costs of our extreme overuse of massive amounts of chemicals in nature and in our food supply. According to researchers, the costs, and like I said, this is like a tip of the iceberg number to me, but it's more than $170 billion a year in Europe alone. And of course, here we have way, way, way more chemical junk being spewed everywhere, pesticides detected in all kinds of foods. And, you know, just we're just swimming in it here in America, even more than Europe, because they've been smart enough to ban a lot of this stuff already. But here, right, we're just still on the unconscious train at 90 miles an hour with blindfolds on, allowing people that worked for Monsanto to now run the FDA, right? We've got a toxic infestation here in the United States, a corrupt parasitic infestation of these chemical ag-type executives that are now helping to make law and legislation around food and drugs and things like that when they shouldn't be anywhere near it. It's a total conflict of interest, right? But in just Europe, $170 billion a year, and that is a conservative estimate of the health costs of people being exposed to all these toxic chemicals. Now, beyond the dollar amount, the human health problems, the study highlights, are staggering. Global experts in this field concluded that infertility and male reproductive dysfunctions, birth defects, obesity, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and neurobehavioral and learning disorders were among the conditions that can be attributed in part to exposure to the endocrine disrupting chemicals. And they're referred to as EDCs, endocrine disrupting chemicals. They screw up our hormones. And you know, human health and human moods and our ability to keep balance through life has to do with a complex synergy of hormone production. And this is what's going on. These things are totally hormone disruptors by destabilizing the endocrine system. And that is from a summary of this research. Nneka Leba, Deputy Director of Research for Environmental Working Group. I love Environmental Working Group. They do so much wonderful work to help us be aware. She points out that endocrine disruptors are found in common products around the world. Potent hormone disruptors such as bisphenol A or BPA, right? It's in the lining of most canned goods and on many cash register receipts. Hey, there's a new one. I didn't even know that, right? I'm pretty well informed. I think I'm fairly well informed, but I didn't know. Cash register receipts? Are you kidding me? So everybody, even if you decide not to drink out of plastic bottles, which I don't because I know about the BPA, you mean every time I pick up a receipt when I buy something, I might be having it? What do we have to do? Wear gloves to go out in the world so we don't even touch this stuff? We already have all kinds of junk in our air. What in the world are we thinking? It's on cash register receipts? Are you kidding? Well, I had no idea. Then we have phthalates. They are PVC in PVC plastic, food packaging, and personal care products. We also have brominated flame retardants that are ubiquitous in most upholstered furniture. These things are all toxic for us. Researchers found that in the EU, intellectual disabilities caused by prenatal, this is before you're even born, exposure to pesticides containing organophosphates, which are endocrine disruptors, were the number one cost that this is factored into this. The number one cause factoring into this huge billions of dollars cost. Intellectual disabilities. Why would we want people to be unintelligent? Why would we want people to not have the ability to procreate and have the ability to reproduce? Why would we want to make people sick with this stuff? Why? Well, we'll have to just leave that to our imagination right now. But we know that the effects are devastating. We know it does cause all of these reproductive disorders, hormone disruption. So if we know that, you would think, hey, don't do that, right? When you're little, you touch the stove, you burn your hand, ow, you learn, don't do that again, right? Why don't we learn with this? Because we have gradual and slowly accumulating effects that we don't see clearly. But this analysis is giving a clearer picture of it, and I'm happy to be sharing it with you. Thank you so much, Common Dreams. This analysis demonstrates just how staggering the cost of widespread endocrine-disrupting chemical exposure is to society. And this is from Leonardo Trasande, associate professor at New York University, who led the study. He says this research crystallizes more than three decades of laboratory and population-based studies of endocrine-disrupting chemicals in the EU. And of course, here in the United States, it's much worse because we have way more of these chemicals that we're being exposed to than they do in the EU. So, as they say in the study, it is not just a European problem. Americans are more massively and routinely exposed to endocrine-disrupting chemicals in everyday consumer products. And they're everywhere, in all American households, even if you're working hard to be as conscientious as you can. And that's why we've got to be ever more conscientious. You know, sometimes I'll tell someone something like, oh, you know, it's not really good to drink out of those squishy plastic bottles because they leak hormone-disrupting chemicals into your water. I tell people things like this, like just randomly, right? That's who I am. And I like to inform people so that they can make a better choice. But then you see them the next week, the next month, and they're still drinking out of the thing. Well, you can't always make a difference, but you can just sort of lead the way a little bit. But this is big, and we've got young people having all kinds of hormone problems that they shouldn't even be having. All kinds of different symptoms and disease states that are propagated through hormone disruption. So be aware of those endocrine disruptors. It's the number one biggest cost to human health that's causing us to be sick and sicker all the time. So make those good choices. Don't eat out of plastic as much as you can help it. You know, I don't even like it that all our food in stores, a lot of it is wrapped in plastic that you get. You know, I just always feel like, ugh, you know, like it's right there against the cheese or it's right there against whatever. If we could just get our, you know, what is plastic, right? It is a petroleum, something you can do as a petroleum byproduct that you can make. So we've got our oil-based, fossil fuel-based energy economy that is ruining the climate, ruining our quality of life on Earth, destroying natural habitats all over the place. And then we have the byproducts of it, and we wrap all our food with it, and we make everything out of plastic, and we got all this piles and piles of junk that is made from petroleum byproducts. So the entire life cycle of petroleum is destructive to us on all levels. When we mine the earth and dig up the result of millions of years of the decomposition of all the ancient flora and fauna that lived on this earth, and we dig up that oil and we burn it up in the atmosphere, we reduce our oxygen level, we cause all kinds of problems, and then we make a bunch of junk out of it that we then expose ourselves to and cause even more health problems. So the whole thing, the whole entire petroleum-based economy on all levels has got to be replaced with something better, and not stuff like fracking. You know, that's another toxic thing that's ruining water supplies. Clean, green, sustainable energies, building a global economy that works, and that works from the bottom up and the top down and all the, every dimension in between. We can do it. And we do it by covering the ground, by planting more gardens, by sequestering carbon through dynamic carbon sequestration, by allowing more plant life, by leaving room for nature to exist here with us and quit hogging all the resources and just denying life to so many creatures out there. You know, we want to go digging more oil. We want to go drilling in the oceans. You know, we want to go destroy more. Oh, we have to give the oil companies who have already overspent their welcome by ruining enough of nature and poisoning enough of us. And yeah, oh, we're stuck. We're stuck using gas. Why? Because of tons of suppression of the better technologies that are out there. We've just got to stop. We've got to stop this. And we've got to change. That's our real future. And it's exciting. But it's also very, you know, can be very frustrating to have to sit here and watch more and more and more concessions going out. Oh, sure, we can just keep poisoning everything just a little bit less, maybe. No, a lot less. We've got to do a lot better, a whole lot better, like leaps and bounds better, like a quantum leap of awareness. You know, that is where we're at. And we can do it. In the spirit of love, we reach out, we help each other, we get on the same team of being Earth stewards together, we get honest, we quit lying to ourselves about what we're doing, about what's going on. You know, some people talk about fake ingredients and things in some products. You know, like one of the most disgusting ones I've heard about is that there's a shortage of calamari. But boy, they're still selling calamari everywhere. What is it? Well, one radio show host there on This American Life actually found out that they were sourcing what looked like calamari was actually rectums from hogs. Hog rectums sliced up in little calamari circular shapes, fried up. Hey, you can't even tell the difference. Wow. Hog bungholes. That's what's being sold as calamari. And you know what? That's not the only thing. There's tons of things out there that there's not nearly that, but they're selling it as that. And, you know, I wonder, what is going on? How can we still be doing it, right? Yesterday, I was walking through a grocery store and I saw a deli guy slicing this bright red slice of something. For a minute, I thought it was watermelon. It was that bright red. And then I glanced a little closer and I realized it appeared to be tuna. You know, the fresh, bright pink tuna. And, you know, tuna are endangered. They're the most heavy metal condensing meat that you can eat from the ocean. They have accumulated, as the large fish that hunt, they've accumulated mercury from lots of other smaller fish. They're the most intensely concentrated meat containing the neurotoxin mercury that you can get. And then the tuna are very endangered. We've already overfished over 90%+ of all the ocean's fish. So how are we still supplying tuna to all these places? And it looked very dyed to me. It looked so bright that it was like fake looking, you know? And we've got to start uncovering what we're really doing, that we're not sustainable. And we've got to uncover where we're being sold fake stuff that isn't what we say it is when it's on the label. And one of the biggest things that has just come to light regarding this, a recent story out, is our nation's biggest honey packer, the biggest honey packer in the country, admits to laundering Chinese honey, in effect. Yes, this came out, a story with Dan Charles on NPR that was bombshell news from the world of honey a few weeks ago, and somehow Of course, mainstream media misses it like they do most all the rest of the real stories out there. Two big honey packers, including one of the largest in the country, Grubb Farms of Onsted, Michigan, admitted buying millions of dollars worth of honey that was falsely labeled. The goal of this mislabeling, which has been long suspected in the honey industry, was to acquire cheap honey from China. Chinese honey is subject to steep anti-dumping duties that the U.S. imposed back in 2008 after U.S. honey producers complained that Chinese exporters were selling their honey at artificially low prices. Chinese exporters, however, began sending their honey to middlemen in countries like Indonesia and Vietnam, who then relabeled it as a local product and sent it on to the U.S. In another tactic, Chinese exporters labeled containers of honey as something else, such as rice syrup, trying to get that into the country. And then, you know, we know that in China, they've already lost a large portion of their arable land due to overuse of toxic chemicals. And you know those bees are being exposed to all kinds of toxic chemicals, just as they are here. It's so hard to have truly organic honey because they roam around, they fly around for miles. So you've got to have miles of organic areas to even have really organic honey. So we've got all kinds of potential toxins being found in what we're being labeled as honey here in the United States. Both of the companies face criminal charges, but they've struck a deal. Yes, another strike a deal thing. And then what happens when you strike a deal and settle a case? Nobody takes blame. Nobody admits guilt or culpability. They just pay it off and put it away. Can you imagine if you were a kid and you got in trouble and you could just pay your parent a bunch of money to not spank you or to not get you restricted or something like that? This is what goes on. They misbehave. They do crime, not just misbehavior, but absolute criminal behavior here going on in the food industry and in the chemical ag industry, poisoning, you know, nature and us and everything. You can really not even calculate the damages that are being done by these industries. And then they get to strike a deal. Oh, let's strike a deal. Let's pay off. Let's settle so that we don't admit that we're guilty. And then we basically can go on continuing to do the kinds of things we were doing. So I don't like to hear that somebody struck a deal. That just means it gets swept under the rug and somebody paid somebody to stay quiet. They avoid prosecution, and you don't get any consequences, and then we just have more and more corruption like this going on. The companies promise to play by the rules and to set up programs to ensure that all the honey they buy in the future comes from legitimate sources, but they've already shown they can't be trusted. So, you know, I don't really go for these deals, right? Grubb Farms also replaced its senior management last summer, so they clean house, get a bunch of fresh faces in there, and say, oh, it's all going to be better now. This is a huge deal for the industry, the first admission by a U.S. packer, the actual user, that they were knowingly importing mislabeled honey. And this is from Eric Winger, chairman of True Source Honey, an industry consortium that has set up an auditing and testing system to guarantee the true origin of honey. Where is it coming from? What is it being labeled as? What is it being mixed with? Is it being mixed with other syrups and other things that denude the quality? Is it even where it says it's from? Or is it from somewhere else? True Source Honey was formed in 2010. According to Wegner, the True Source certified honey now accounts for at least a quarter of U.S. honey consumption. Joe Clark, vice president for the sales and marketing at Dutch Gold Honey in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, which helped set up the program, wrote in an email that recent indictments are just another reason why we felt it was necessary to verify ethical sourcing of honey. So get honey from your local people. Okay, find a local farmer, a beekeeper that offers honey. And, you know, we just love that delicious sourwood honey. You can get the different blossoms that come throughout the year and have different kinds of honey. Get your honey locally as much as you can because we don't know what is we're being exposed to with this stuff. So get that local honey and avoid getting the store-bought honey because who knows? Who knows what is in there or where it's really from? Okay. Next story here on Earth Art Network News, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition. So glad to have you with us. Hopefully we'll be hearing from Patrick Battle soon. We'll have This Week in the Garden. He will go over what we can be doing. Yes, it's flat out time, time to go wild planting everything you can, everything except for peppers and tomatoes, you know, a few of those hotter weather things we can wait for, but it's great. And we'll be hearing from him soon on Earth Art Network Radio. Meanwhile, you know, I've tried to get people to be inspired to take action on things they care about, to get out there and do something about something you really feel passionately about, to reach out to other people and make people aware and to try to be an active part of our community and to get together in the team spirit of Earth Stewardship and really make a positive difference every day. And so many adults, you know, they've got their little dent in the couch over there to keep working on making deeper and deeper, and they just sit there in front of mind-numbing TV shows, and they go to mind-numbing jobs and then come home and eat mind-numbing food, and that's their miserable life, right? And they don't even, oh, I just don't have the energy to even do anything about anything. Well, of course not. You know, not living your passion and not eating healthy food and not doing inspiring things, it becomes a downward spiral of less and less energy and less care about life. When your quality of life is awful, then of course you don't care as much about going out there and making a difference in the world, because people get so miserable, they don't have the energy to do it. But you know what? I am very proud of a certain young man, and he is doing things, and he's inspiring his generation to do things, and he's inspiring lots of adults and leaders around the world as well. He's getting together, and he's making a difference every day. And I want to share this little story here from Gold Coast Bulletin. This is from Charis Chang, and this is a story about a very inspiring young man, Jutecarl Roque Martinez, 15 years old. He says he is assembling a teen army to get together to work on the future. He wants to have life on Earth. You know, they want to have a good future. And he's got a group of young people suing governments over climate change. Yes, they're getting a lawsuit. I say, if you're not going to make good change and give us a chance for a future, we're suing you because you're not taking responsibility. You're leaving us dead broke for the future. And when this group of teenagers first started taking governments to court over the lack of climate change action, people laughed at them. Oh, right, teenagers are going to sue us for ruining the Earth. Oh, sure, yeah, right. Well, they're not laughing now. Just recently, we've got a brand new thing here. A U.S. court is considering whether 21 young people have a right to sue the U.S. government, even President Barack Obama and other federal agencies, for their failure to tackle climate change. You know, we sit here and we allow ecocidal industry. We know what it's doing, and yet there's not action being taken that is significant and dramatic. Like I said, we need to take a big step forward, not these little tiny steps. We'll run out of atmosphere. We're running out of time. You know, it's not the kind of thing you wait on, right? When you're sitting there having some emergency situation, you don't say, oh, well, we'll do it later. You don't do that, right? We're in a climate emergency. We've already had the mega hottest February in world history just past us. We've got huge increase in the average global temperature for the what those numbers mean. And meanwhile, these teens are saying, hey, they realize it. You're leaving us nothing for the future. You're leaving us a wrecked planet. This is not cool. So they're doing it. They're getting out there and really taking it to legal action. The young people say they have a constitutional right to life, liberty, and property. And this is being violated because of the federal government's support of fossil fuels. Magnificent, isn't it? Isn't it the truth? Don't we all deserve a right to life and liberty and the ability to live on our planet and not allow some ecocidal industry to ruin it for everybody? A whole cadre of ecocidal industries that think that that's business as usual is just to destroy life on Earth and to mine the Earth and take everything and leave it broken and empty? That's not okay anymore. And we've just got to change, right? We've just got to do peaceful, powerful, positive steps every day. And Jutecarl is doing it. He is out there inspiring people. He was at the Paris talks. He's keeping on this. And now they're making some real progress. For those that think it's ridiculous, they may yet be proved right. But right now, similar groundbreaking action is taking place in the Netherlands. And it was successful last year with the government ordering to cut emissions more quickly. In a separate lawsuit against the state of Washington, the government was ordered to look at its response in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, eventually resulting in Governor Jay Inslee directing regulators to cap emissions and curb them by 50%. And then we have the caveat, right, by 2050. We don't have that much time to cut back on our foolish ways. We've got to be more urgently adopting the most intelligent choices that we have, the best options possible. So, as Philip Gregory said, Congress and the president have not acted effectively to solve the climate crisis. They are lawyers for the plaintiffs. As with civil rights cases, the courts must act. Now we've got companies lining up against the teens. They're trying to fight these young people. And, you know, we've got this lawsuit going on. We've got, of course, Zutecatl, he's 15. We've got Kelsey Juliana, she's 19. We've got Levy Draheim, he's an 8-year-old down in Indian Atlantic, Florida. And he says, I work hard to protect the environment and the animals near my home. I want my government to work harder to protect my future and the future of the animals and ecosystems in our country. This is from an 8-year-old. Okay, if the little kids know, shouldn't we be listening? Shouldn't we be aware? Shouldn't we know by now? Can't we see what we're doing? And as Zutecatl says, climate change is the defining issue of our time. The actions those in power take and decisions they make today will determine the kind of world future generations will inherit. And then the most scary part to me is on top of it, we have humans thinking that engineering the weather is going to be a better option than working with nature. And we've already seen the results of that, devastating weather patterns that are highly destructive. So that's not the answer either. We've got to be doing walking in the footsteps of nature, learning from nature, not saying, oh, some engineer knows better than nature. That's not possible, right? Nature has there's a form of supreme intelligence in nature that no human can surpass. And that's another big thing we have to realize. But great to see these young people not only doing something about their future that they care about, but banding together and taking it to court and taking it to out there, inspiring others and, you know, doing things, really getting involved. And that's what it takes. And they're facing some opposition here with these big companies. Some of the biggest polluters in our country are also taking the latest lawsuit seriously. Almost every fossil fuel-related company in America has asked to join the government as defendants in the case. They argue that the case was a direct substantial threat to their businesses. And you know what? It is. And it should be. And they ought to not be in those businesses of causing death and destruction to everybody. That is not a business model. That's just a death spiral. And how are you going to stay in business anyway if you're destroying life itself? So to me, they're already a direct threat to their own business model. Because you cannot stay in business, we cannot survive, we cannot stay alive with these ecocidal industries out there ruining it for everyone. So, yes, a direct substantial threat to their businesses, and it should be, and not their lawsuit, but our choices to not support those companies is what really should be the direct threat to their businesses. Businesses that have no business being in business. This includes some of the most powerful companies in the country. You know, the big polluters, we've got the biggest oil spill in history, BP wrecking the Gulf of Mexico. We've got ExxonMobil up there with the Valdez oil spill wrecking that beautiful Gulf up there. We've got Shell out there destroying tons of rainforest, poisoning miles and miles of jungles and people and everything there. We've got Koch Industries doing tons of effort to stop good progress so they can just keep making money on things that destroy life. It's not the kind of business that you stay in anyway, because it's got a dead end. If you've got a dead end business model, then it's a dead end business. So they're putting lots of their substantial resources into making sure to see if they can make that legal action fail. So, you know, this might be something that strikes a nerve with you, a chord of passion to say, yes, I want to support this in some way. Maybe I want to learn more about it. The gentleman who is litigating this case says the fossil fuel industry would not want to be in court unless it understood the significance of our case. The litigation is a momentous threat to the fossil fuel companies. And you know, it's high time that we really invest in a cleaner, greener future. There is no future with a bunch of pollution and destruction going on. That's just a dead end. So renowned former NASA scientist Dr. James Hansen has lodged the lawsuit along with the 21 young people. He really is a guy who stands up for what he believes in. He was a NASA scientist working on climate, and he quit because he realized there was no point in working in the way he was. They wasn't able to make adequate progress within the system he was in. And now he's helping and standing with these young people, 21 young people between the ages of 8 and 20, who are being supported financially by the not-for-profit organization Our Children's Trust. The case is due to come before the U.S. District Court in Oregon. And the lawsuit could be forcing governments to implement a national plan to decrease carbon dioxide in the air to 350 parts per million by the end of the century. We've got to be able to really commit now. And, you know, we've got to be able to commit and stick with it. This young man who has spearheaded this, Zutecatl Roque Martinez, that I was mentioning earlier, is really a young leader in this movement. And you just look at him and he's a young Native American man. He's raised in the Aztec tradition, and he loves the earth, and he's inspiring people to care and to get involved. He was raised in Colorado and has appeared before the United Nations General Assembly to speak about climate change. He's been part of the environmental movement since he was 6 years old. In a YouTube video, he said people had relied on governments and political leaders to make changes, but it hasn't happened. He says, our generation is going to be the most impacted by climate change. Therefore, our generation has the most at stake, and we have the most power in this matter, he said. Tagging themselves, Generation RYSE, which stands for Rising Youth Sustainable Earth, the group aims to empower thousands of young people to demand action on climate change. More lawsuits are likely. The Oregon case is part of a growing movement towards using litigation to force governments to act on climate change. And, you know, whenever we keep saying act on climate change and when we know we've got tons of weather modification going on, it's like we need to not only do things that help climate change that are natural, that are not further toxifying our environment. And, you know, because we've got all this idea of weather modification out there, and it's being done, and things are being sprayed, and things are going on, and it's not better. That even makes everything worse and more unstable. And again, why is that going on? Well, we have to leave that to our imagination, but many changes are happening. More litigation is coming. More lawsuits are being filed. Professor Timothy Stevens of Sydney Law School, University of Sydney, said he believed the lawsuits are just the beginning. They're just starting up. He said, I think we'll see lots of innovative legal actions all around the world to force governments to act. We'll see more litigation, especially because governments are not taking meaningful steps. You know, we have these big, huge meetings about cutting emissions, and then we get all these non-binding agreements. Those are pretty much useless. It's high time we have binding agreements. You know, if you don't pay your bill, you get a consequence. It's the planet. It's not a car payment, right? It's the planet, and we have unbinding agreement? It's beyond insane, in my opinion. It's so far beyond. But guys like him, Ziutikatl, and his lawyers and his group of young people certainly give me hope, because not only are they willing to take meaningful, powerful action, they're willing to stick with it. And they're young enough and empowered enough to really get out there and make a difference. So more power to you, the young folks. And let's get up there too, us that are sitting here making that dent in the couch just a little deeper every day. Get up and get out there and get involved. And you know what? Support some of the young people that are trying to make a difference for the planet. A number of legal challenges have already been lodged in Australia over government decisions. Many of them have been unsuccessful so far, but people are still pushing those legal boundaries. And they're trying to have more international action on this issue. And I'm so glad that these young people like Ziutikatl Martinez are out there truly making a difference every day, suing the governments over climate change, saying, hey, we want to live. We want to live, and we have a right to life. And you need to do something about this. And so, hey, I am so happy to hear about stuff like that. Well, you know, we have to look at making progress, and then every once in a while you get knocked back. You know, we've got things going on with weather. We had the monarchs losing tons of them, and now we had a big comeback this year, and then all of a sudden, a big winter storm of historic proportions struck the monarch sanctuaries in Mexico. There is no word yet about how many monarchs were affected, but the storm began with rain, was followed by hail, then snow and sub-freezing temperatures. The butterflies are more susceptible to mortality from freezing when wet. This happened here as a spring storm, and they're still looking at the impact. And, you know, when I know, because I read everything, I know the weather's being engineered. I mean, people that don't, and you can find it, it's publicly disclosed. You know, we've got all kinds of stuff going on out there. It's known if you just look around. Wow, why do we end up with this exact storm that can decimate the monarchs in a very big way? Who engineered that? That's what I wonder, because I know it's going on. Was this just some freak? Wow, nature's really freaky these days. Another super freaky weather event. This is humans thinking they're smarter than nature again. Let the monarchs come back. Let life on Earth live. Let nature be regulating itself instead of being jacked around by weather engineers that do not, frankly, know what they're doing when it comes to nature. The mysteries of the depths of nature are beyond human comprehension. We can only begin to comprehend when we are humble and when we observe, not when we sit there and pump, you know, the atmosphere with frequencies and particulate matter and cause these storms and extreme weather events to happen all over the place. Nature knows better. We've got to support more nature, more greenery, covering the bare ground, right? As I said last week, as Ray said, Ray Archuleta, the conservation agronomist within RCS, nature is not a nudist. Cover it, right? Cover that soil. Do things that make sense. Do things that are going to work long term. Maybe somebody isn't going to become a mega billionaire by destroying something over it, but you know what? We don't need that anyway. We need to come together and protect what's really valuable, and that's our planet and our natural systems that we rely on for life. There are people who still live in the jungles of what is left of the great Amazon. There are women out there in these communities that are fighting for their rights. And on International Women's Day, which is this month, and this is Women's History Month, March, we've got all kinds of women activists in these natural areas trying to protect their societies. And on International Women's Day this year, over 500 indigenous women of the Amazon and allies for climate justice, indigenous rights, got together on International Women's Day. They all got out there in Puyo, Ecuador, on March the 9th in recognition of International Women's Day. Indigenous Amazonian women leaders of seven nationalities, including Andoa, Achuar, Quichua, Shuar, Shiwiar, Sapara, and Waorani nationalities, and their international allies, took action in Puyo, Ecuador, in a forum and in a march in defense of the Amazon, Mother Earth, and for climate justice. Specifically, they came together to denounce a newly signed oil contract between the Ecuadorian government and Chinese oil corporation, Andes Petroleum. By plane, by foot, by canoe, and some by bus, these 500 indigenous women mobilized from deep in their rainforest territories and nearby provinces, marching through the streets of the Amazon jungle town of Puyo, chanting, "Defend the forest, don't sell it," carrying signs reading, "No more prosecution against women defenders of Mother Earth." And just lately, we've had more assassinations of women trying to protect their indigenous lands and the knowledge that their tribes contain for thousands of years. They're fighting for that connection to nature that we still have. We still have it. And that's why it's so urgent to support their efforts, support the efforts of the youth, and to get out there and go ahead and take action on those things you care about most. Well, we're joined now by Patrick Battle for This Week in the Garden. It's always exciting. And now, spring is here. It's official. It is official. It's been a little chilly lately, but it is official. And I have a beautiful swallowtail butterfly floating by the window here, out there, and things blossoming all over. So how are you doing this week? It's full-on spring, right? Here we go.
It is so full-on. I just can't keep straight what I got to do next. It's just that time of year, you know? Just this morning, Bob Anderson helped me with a box full of Scion wood that Ed Updike, folks, that's probably not a familiar name to most people, but he's one of my heroes. Ed Updike was retired as a general practitioner surgeon in Florida, as he said, back in the day when medicine wasn't a business, when you treated everybody, whether they could pay you or not. And, you know, from 12-hour days as a doctor and surgeon to a farmer in Brevard. And I met him when he was about my age. He's now 89 and having to sell his property. If anybody is interested, by the way, he has a lovely property in Brevard, loaded with Lee Calhoun's heirloom fruit trees. He's got a huge array of wonderful apple trees. He's also got a lot of nuts and a pond. I'm sure it's going to be hard for him to leave, but we all have to go through those passages. And Ed is reaching a point where, you know, that's just a little more than he can handle. He's the assisted living place he's going to live to, though, he's already agreed to teach organic gardening. He's just one of my heroes. One of the things he did was come out here before Mr. Ed was Mr. Ed, and do one of the very first workshops we ever did out here called Rocking with Microbes through the Organic Grower School. And he sat up in the great house with a microscope and projected it onto a screen and showed the kids the microbes on a screen. And so Ed has been, activist of the year for Carolina Farm Stewardship back in the 90s. Well deserved that. Made it a point to raise funds and distribute soil biology primers to all the schools. Really just a wonderful hero. And about 2 weeks ago, he called up us up and said, are you ever going to come get that no-till drill from the 1930s that I wanted to give you, which he could have sold to somebody else, but he donated it and several other great pieces of equipment to Living Web Farms. And while we were out there, he said, all these trees, they're all here, and it's not too late. I can give you Scion wood. And that was right before I took a trip to Florida. He had to do it all by himself, but he gave me a box full of Scion wood, all different kinds of apples. I mean, some of the names, Sweet 16, Aesop's Spitzenberg, all these wonderful apples. And this morning at 8:30 in the morning, still quite chilly, Bob Anderson and his brother-in-law, Paul, and I went up to the Mills River, North Mills River property, and we did a few grafts. I got to practice grafting again. I'll be doing a bunch more, looking for apple trees that are accessible to us that we can put this Scion wood on, so that it can, when it grows out, if we need it, we can come back and get it. You know, we kind of want to have it someplace in our general area, and we're happy to share it with people that are willing to make that wood available to us should we want to get a particular type tree and graft it. So if anybody out there is in the general Mills River area, someplace within a half hour or so, and they have an interest in old-timey apples, and they have some mature trees that can have grafts put onto them, we're looking to do that in the immediate future. It's pretty exciting for me, Lisa, because it's only the second time that I got to do that kind of grafting myself, and I'm pretty thrilled with the prospect of it and hoping to be more successful. My first two grafts started growing and did good for about 3 weeks and then died. I was in good company. Bob's grafts died too. The only grafts that made it for that was that one grafting workshop we did on my cherry tree. The only ones that made it were Andrew Brown's. The other ones just, and according to Bob, that's the luck of grafting. It's not like they always work. You're trying to get this incredibly small area of cambium to match up with this incredibly small area of cambium on the tree. And you just have to hope that you line it up right. So I got another shot of that today. It was pretty exciting. And then got to go to the school and take the kids out from the school and show them what grafting was and talk to them about grafting. And Bob had a great idea to talk to them, get them to think about the turn idea of their getting a cut and how it heals up. And that's a similar process that happens with the grafting. And then ironically, this afternoon, I will be grafting some 40 tomatoes. It's time to graft the tomatoes for the greenhouse. So that's the job. As soon as I finish with you, I go on down to the office, get a lot of bright lights up, and start grafting. So it's a day of grafting here at Mr. Ed.
Right, and we're kind of grafting from winter into spring now, and then, of course, everything transforms. And what a miraculous little lesson for those children to learn that you can cut one tree and put it with another one and bring it together, and nature will grow, and it can be a new fruit. That just must have been absolutely miraculous to those little children. And they're so sweet over there at the school, and that just must have been just one of those lessons you remember when I first learned about grafting. You know, it must just seem like a miracle for them. And I was so thrilled, Pat, the other day when we were there for the workshop, seeing all of the fruiting, flowering trees that we had trimmed from that orcharding workshop with Andrew and Bob. And we actually wanted to follow up and show some of those flowerings and see how the pruning, you know, helped those trees then regrow in new ways, and seeing all those blossoms coming now and looking at some good fruit set. Hopefully we didn't have too much frost on that. What do you think?
Well, yeah, it's still completely vulnerable. We could easily still have, last year all the fruit got frosted off. And we're nowhere near out of the woods, you know.
Right.
Every year you just hope, that's all. There's a fair amount of gambling with every grower, you know. You have to be willing to take a risk because nature is full of risks, you know. And that's the excitement of it, you know. I mean, you're bound to hit a few. If you take a bunch, you're bound to hit a few. You're bound to miss a few, and you just have to let go of that. And the good news is that you get another shot next year. That's the great part about gardening, is you never have lost. You just have to delay until you succeed, you know?
Well, I'm hoping that all of those apple orchards there along Edneyville in the Fruitland area are going to make it with their apples this year. And I've got a whole peach tree out here full of blossoms, and hopefully they will hang on to have enough peaches. We had just a few last year, but it's certainly beautiful to see, and the butterflies all around it right now.
Yeah, you know, it's always beautiful, and sometimes we luck out and we actually get fruit too. We are in the same situation here. We have a lot blossoming. Ironically, Bob wanted to teach me a new grafting technique, and the apple trees aren't quite far enough along yet. Only one was beginning to bud open up. The rest haven't even swelled enough that the bark was loose enough. This is one where you put a slit in the bark, and you slide this pin, which is what he said the local folks call your Scion wood. You slide the pin where you've sliced the bottom half off so the Scion wood touches down against the cambium from that slice, and just you slip it into this little slit in the bark and you tape it up. And it was just, we tried it today and the bark was still too tight. Hasn't come loose enough yet that you can make a slit and slide a pin, so to speak, or piece of cyanwood into it. So we're still early for a lot of things. I mean, it's just beginning, you know. Somebody was just emailing me today about what they could still start, and it's just, you can still start everything. But the only thing that may be iffy is spinach. If we suddenly get way hot and have a hot April and May, then your spinach may not do well. But I think it's still worth the gamble. I if you want to do spinach, I say jump on it right away, you know. But it's a fine time, I guess, to just go into what you can be doing right now, and that is starting all of your hardy or even half hardy vegetables, you know. And depending, if you're going to offer a little protection, you could even be starting things like tomatoes. I don't, unless you have a serious greenhouse, we do, and we have started already our peppers and eggplant, but just barely. Unless you have a greenhouse where you can really keep things warm, I would wait on peppers and eggplant. But otherwise, if you're willing to just use things like wall of waters or row cover and then a layer of plastic, you can start just about anything now. You know, it's far enough along that if you're willing to give protection, you can push it and try to get some early crops. Will you be successful? Probably. Could you get hit by a severe late cold spell? Yes, and that could take out your efforts, you know. But just remember, if you're starting these things and you suddenly get shocked, I mean, I've ever been in CeeLo where in late April, the temperatures plunged into the low, low 20s, and that just killed everything in the garden. I didn't know to protect it. I thought, oh, it's all hardy stuff. It'll be fine. Now I'd know to protect it, but probably given how much warmth there is and how much growth we get, probably even if you had a layer of fabric and a layer of plastic, it plunged down into the low, low 20s, then you probably would want a third layer. You can always do that, enough layers, and you just slow down that process enough that the plants make it through it. So just know that you can start anything right now, but the things that are most practical to start, that take the least work, are all of the cooking greens. That includes the brassica families like mustard and collards and kale and all of those, turnip greens, all those. And then also the beet family, Chenopodium family, that includes chard and spinach. All of those can be started right now and planted out. All of your hardy herbs can be started now. That includes all the Mediterranean ones that we mostly do by division, things like oregano and thyme, winter savory, all of those, lavender, tarragon, all of those can be divided and grown into nice little plants to use right now. But also all of the hardy herbs like parsley, all the Apiaceae or umbrophilia herbs, all the ones in the carrot family, parsley, chervil, cilantro, cutting celery. Actually, it's a good time to start regular celery too. Celery takes about 8 weeks at least, if not 10 weeks, to be ready for planting. And that will probably take you up into a time where the nights will not be consistently in the 50s. You don't want to put them out until the nights are consistently in the 60s. Otherwise, the celery can bolt, go to seed a little early. But given that it can take 10 weeks, you know, you just look at where we are now, we're in the last part of March, that means you'll be putting them out in late May, early June, and the temperature should be settled enough that they'll do fine at that time, you know. Likewise, maybe in about 2 weeks, you can start your fennel because they're going to come in a little faster. But all those kind of plants and the Chinese cabbage, they all want to be started a little later. Not that they can't take a lot of cold, but unfortunately that cold has them experience what the plant experiences as winter, and they kind of skip putting a lot of growth on that we can eat and go right to making seed. So those plants probably are, in particular, the fennel, the celery, Chinese cabbage, a little later for them. Otherwise, all the cooking greens, all the, you know, for planting out, if you're out of bed prepared, it's a great time to sow carrots. I wait about 2 weeks or so before I sowed parsnips, so I could be a little bit further into the spring. Not that they won't work now, but you might have quite a big core by the time they've had enough cold to really taste good, you know. If they get started early enough, then they start making a flower, start going towards bolting even before the year's up. Usually they don't make that core until the next year. You know, like I'll be digging some parsnips that we got in late, and they didn't do great. They'll probably be about the size of young carrots, but they'll probably have a core in them because it's already gone through solstice, and they're trying to get ready to go to seed now. So those are the kind of things we can be doing right now. Of course, getting other beds ready. You know, if you don't have a bed ready to plant carrots, you could be preparing it with this kind of dry weather. We have really good weather for getting things prepared right now, and then stale bedding it, letting it go stale, watering it, bringing the weeds on, and then either flaming them off or skimming them off, barely disturbing that top eighth inch of soil so you don't bring new seedweed.
Pat, we lost you.
Okay.
Oh, there you are now. Okay.
Yeah. I just stopped. That was a pause.
Oh, okay. It was a very abrupt. I wasn't used to it. Like, whoa, oh.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
Now, the other thing, Pat, I wanted to mention, because this is that perfect little time right before the heat makes all those fresh spring greens get better, right? So we can be harvesting those fresh dandelion greens and stuff
all
out
the
there.
Yep. I just took the kids on a wild greens walk. And indeed, even the centers of the dock, you know, are actually, they all enjoy it. They all said, oh, the finish is, you know, they didn't use the word finish, but the end of the taste, you know, is a little bit strong. But up front, they liked it a whole lot. So they were just tasting all the wild greens today. They love the dandelion. They love the dock. They love the chickweed, you know, just roaming around. We just went on wild food walk, and it's so much fun to watch those kids just chowing down on all that stuff. Yes, it's a great time to get out there. I was a little disappointed. We're teaching cooking tomorrow night, Meredith and I, and I'd hoped to make a nettle soup. But the nettles, at least up in CeeLo, just aren't far enough along yet, you know. But pretty soon they will be. And that's one of the most exciting greens of spring. It's just so loaded with nutrients. It makes the richest, darkest, greenest, brightest, greenest soup you've ever made.
Wow, that sounds so wonderful. I really enjoyed the nettle pesto that Mark Williams had made last year. And I just saw a recipe for nettle gnocchi, a really interesting looking recipe using the stinging nettles with like the little potato gnocchi, you know, making those little pastas, and had that recipe there. And I look at it and I'm like, oh, I just want to make that. You know, it looks so wonderful. Basically some egg and flour and potatoes and some nettles and making nettle gnocchi. And then I saw a beautiful nettle cake and just so many things you can do with it.
The one advice I give to everybody is make sure you cook it enough. Nettle is not something that you want to have al dente. The reason you want to cook it enough is if you don't, you will experience the nettles themselves when you taste it. And they won't be, once you've cooked them at all, they won't sting you. But they give you this kind of a gritty taste, that's a texture that's really not very appealing. If you cook it a little bit more, then they're just totally succulent and wonderful. So, you know, that's why I like to make soup from it a lot, because that guarantees that I get them cooked enough. I've undercooked them sometimes and haven't been impressed with their texture. If I was making gnocchi, I would really make sure that I cooked that nettle down quite a bit before I actually tried to make the little gnocchi stuff pastas.
Right. They talk about blanching it first and making sure, you know, that you've got it a little bit cooked there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And
I'm going to send you the link right now. There's the link for you. I want you to have
that.
Great. It's just a fun recipe.
Yeah, well, like I said, I wish it was ready. It was definitely on my list of things to teach. But one of the things I will be teaching, and I probably mentioned it last week, I'll probably mention it all the way through until they stop doing it. This is the time to eat those brassica flower buds. You know, a lot of our brassicas that we planted last year are going to be going to seed or bolting, and they send up flower buds that look just like little broccolis and have a variety of taste. They can taste like collards. They can taste like broccoli. The tatsoi ones are slightly bitter. You know, they're all basically other versions of broccoli rabe. You know, they're very similar to broccoli rabe, but they're all different too. And so I'd keep my eyes out, watch your previous crops from last year, and harvest those tips. I know that one of the dishes I want to make is going to be a polenta cake, just like fried polenta, and I'm going to fry into it sautéed onions, herbs, and brassica tips. This is a lunch that I made myself for at the Highland Lake years ago. It was just an inspiration of the moment because I had to eat in a hurry, and polenta cooks quickly, and I grabbed a big handful of those buds, and I had grabbed some herbs. I didn't know what I was going to do with them when I walked into the kitchen, but then that was my inspiration, and it's a dish I return to every spring because it really delights me as a wonderful vehicle for these wonderful brassica buds.
Well, that just sounds fantastic. It sounds so good to integrate those flavors together. And then that sweetness of the good corn, of course, it must be fabulous. I've got a bunch of brassicas going to seed and I left them. Of course, I've got all kinds of arugula. I love arugula flowers. Man, those taste, they have just some flavor. I love that nutty flavor. And actually,
the nutty flavor that ends in sweet.
Yeah, I just showed them to Avery, my son, yesterday, and he's like, how do you know you can eat these? Because he's been out of the garden for a little while. And I'm like, well, because I planted it and I know what it is, you know? And he ate the first one with a little trepidation, but then he was, you know, cleaning out all the arugula flowers, handfuls of them, just stuffing them in his mouth after that. And I'm like, well, save some for the bees. I've been really loving letting those brassica flowers open up, and I seem to be, you know, now we've got flowers all over, but the bees are really out there, so I try to leave some for them. That's really my most fun I have in the garden, is watching all of the insects and nature, everything interacting. I really do it for that reason, not so much to get everything I can out of the garden. So I find the fun in watching the bees and all the little native species and everyone having a blast out there. It's really makes it fun. But yeah, I've got to maybe try some of those little flower tops in that nice polenta recipe.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. And indeed, I get a whole lot of my pleasure from watching the interactions of the garden too. But what's great about a garden is we can experience it on so many levels. You know, you can experience it on a spiritual level, an aesthetic level, a culinary level, a drama level. You know, there's just so many. And you can experience all of that at once. You know, I mean, be in the garden while you're eating that meal that you made from the garden, you know, and you can experience all of those things. And that's why gardening is the most popular outdoor activity in America. And, you know, has a long history of, you know, being thoroughly and deeply practiced by, you know, humans over time. And it's simply because it is, you know, as I've said before, a portal to the natural world. It's a place where we totally get to connect, you know, unlike the suburban lawn, which is about control. Which, you know, it does as much as possible, except for the few ornamental plantings, to ensure that there is a dearth of life, you know. Any dandelion blooming is a reason to call kennel on, you know. That is not a good way to get people inspired about the natural world. What happens instead is they get inspired about controlling the natural world and ensuring that it fits this regimented model, which I don't know where we got that model from, you know. It's really kind of baffling to me that people ever went that way, when they could have the wonder of, you know, like the English cottage garden, you know. Well, how did we end up with, you know, just these mowed lawns and a few ornamental landscape plants, you know, and precisely trimmed grass everywhere? It just baffles me, never appealed to me.
Yeah, it's so unnatural, and it's so much a marketing thing, right? You get, you know, years of those commercials of, you know, dad's out there with the barbecue and the kids are playing frisbee, and then you got your slip and slide that goes, you know, across this big huge yard or whatever. And we've been marketed all these like plastic toy based outdoor activities for summer, and, you know, that we sort of like tried to replace that, and then, you know, making that lawn to where all that stuff could happen. I mean, I know growing up, and of course I grew up in a very hot area, so, you know, we were always outside playing. Even if it was boiling hot, we were out there doing stuff, and, you know, you had to have a big yard, or you're playing soccer or whatever it is, you know, all these activities that aren't gardening, that don't feed us really, and then we end up poisoning our lawns and our water and each other. But it's really great to say, get back to the garden, dig up that yard, and or at least do some lasagna bedding and get it to create some nice layers and get more stuff growing. I'm glad to see young people getting more excited about gardening. It seems to be a pretty big growing trend.
Yep, and actually I'll be sending a link to you and Mayor to get us on the resource page. But there was just a new study that came out today saying that, you know, all of that application of chemical fertilizers is building up dangerous levels of nitrates in our water, and that they've been building up for decades, and it's going to be decades if we stop using those high salt fertilizers immediately, those highly soluble high salt fertilizers. We stop using them immediately, the impact, the damage to water supplies will last probably another couple of decades or three decades or something. And so the more people pay attention to that, I think the more they're going to be inspired to try to figure out how to let the life of the soil feed their plants, you know, to enhance the life of their soil with cover crops, and, you know, compost tea and compost, and then let that be the source of food for their plants rather than all these highly soluble fertilizers, which are going right into the groundwater, not pass and go, just going directly into the groundwater. And so That's something I hope to get people to look at. I'll send that link to Meredith, and I'll send it to you, and we can get it posted on the resource page. It's another good little study to look at and pay attention to.
Well, that's great. Yeah, we're so happy and proud. We've got over 1 million views now, being able to share all the great workshop videos from the farms from the last 4+ years, and being able to have all of that being shared everywhere and people getting those resources. I've had a bunch of people really excited right now with your seed starting workshop, Pat. And you know, oftentimes we're the main source of instruction for somebody doing a whole garden or even a project in a village. And so everywhere we are inspiring others, we're getting more gardens growing, and then we're doing more of that dynamic carbon sequestration and having better food, right? Because that chemicals we're putting down, it affects the food too, and it builds up in our blood. And so it's really exciting to be able to share this great information, get it out there. And of course, farmers markets are going to be opening up, right?
Absolutely. Great place to buy plants. Great place to get a good sense of what can be grown this time of year. You know, really a major beacon for a sustainable world is your local farmers market. Absolutely. You know.
Now, we're going to be down at the Mills River Farmers Market. I want to try to do, we're going to do maybe a live show there and be able to talk to some of those local farmers that are there, like Joe Britton and others, and help support that local market and inspire people to get out there and get in the habit of going to the markets again. So we'll look for a date to get that here toward the beginning of the season and look forward actually to coming out and meeting folks in person. It's been a great joy lately meeting people at Organic Growers School. We got lots more people jumping on with our email list so we can share the workshops, and also over the weekend at the Green the Garden, Home Garden Green Living Show there. We had some presents, and then we were just running around and putting up the booth, taking it down, and meeting more folks. So it's really great. It's that time of year to get out and meet people as well. So hope to be seeing folks at the farmers markets.
Absolutely. Yeah, and actually, Lisa, as you were talking about the people watching the Seed Saver Workshop and all that, I realized today, while I was doing dishes actually, that we have had a slant that is not as all-encompassing as I want. We really have done loads of workshops, but we have not done a basic beginning gardening workshop. I mean,
right.
the seeds workshop is fine for beginning seed. And by doing fertile ground and those kinds of workshops, we get people to get fertility. But I think for next year, I'm going to schedule maybe one or two, you know, longish workshops where we just take people through every step of getting started with a garden. Because that's something we should have on the web too. You know, I mean, I've certainly taught those classes before, and frankly, that's not something that I'm excited about teaching. I love teaching it, but it's not something that when I'm trying to think of what to teach that I remember to do, because I'm trying to always think, what do we need next? What's the next piece, you know? Where do we go forward? Forgetting that some people, the next thing they need is to learn how to get off their couch and into their front yard or their backyard and get started. And so I'll be making sure we put at least one workshop, if not two, in next year's schedule. It's a little bit too late for this year, and my apologies to any beginning gardeners. They're going to have to pick and choose through our videos to get the information you need. Actually, I do believe it's all there. You know, I do believe that we've covered anything you need to get started. But I think it'd probably be a lot easier if we did it from A to Z in one or two videos. And so that we'll put that out there next year. That's something that, you know, a service that we should have offered by now, and it finally entered my thick skull that it's time to do that.
Well, you know, you've been doing it a long time, Pat, and you're, you know, very advanced in a lot of the modes that you've developed and honed over the years. And so it's kind of hard to think, oh, the need for the total base beginning thing. And, you know, I have heard people request for that, or at the end of a workshop, they came up to me and a lady one time said, wow, this is pretty advanced. I wasn't able to really comprehend most of this. I really just need a beginner's class, you know? And so there's a real place for that and a need, and it will help, I think, maybe help a lot of the people that just get so intimidated or who've told themselves, oh, I have a brown thumb my whole life, to say, it's okay. Here's the baby steps and go ahead and get started and then grow in their knowledge. And I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. And there aren't any brown thumbs. No. Every human being has it innately in them to be able to work with plants and grow them. We have always been connected to them. It's simply a matter of relaxing into it and learning some basic things to start with. And once you learn those basic things, you don't make the few mistakes that are so demoralizing and make you think you have a brown thumb. So
right.
We'll call that class, you know, there are no brown thumbs. That might be the name of that class.
Or green and growing, beginning gardening, and then say, by the way, no brown thumbs.
Right, yeah.
People, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I've done that. You know, I've gotten people into a little bit. I try to give them a few plants or something, and they say, well, I can't guarantee that I'm going to keep them alive or not. Everything dies around me. And I say, well, just try it. Just try it and just give it a chance. And next thing you know, they're bringing me vegetables with a big smile on their face.
Yep, that's really satisfying, isn't it? I love when that happens, you know. I love to have empowered another gardener, you know. And there are years when somebody I just taught how to garden does better with a crop than I did, you know. Maybe they paid better attention, you know, the conditions were better, or, you know, just better genetics for whatever reason. I've ever had people give me food, and I taught them how to grow it, and I didn't succeed in growing that crop myself. And that's one of the joys of being a teacher, is when your students outdo you, you know. Absolutely.
Right, that's the mark of really a great teacher, is when the students can just jump out there and do it and excel and learn and be able to run with that knowledge as it's shared. Spawning and seeding out everywhere, right? We've got stuff blowing all over the place. I've got little flowers falling out of the sky. I don't know where they're coming from. It's really gorgeous. And sometimes we just spread that knowledge out and we don't even know if it's going to take or land in a rocky spot or in fertile ground. But then after a while, just keep doing it. And then we've got huge growth in people really learning and sharing this. So it's a great joy.
Absolutely. Yeah, and this is the time. I mean, it's time to just roll in it, you know. There is probably no more exciting time than spring. There's plenty of other wonderful aspects to being in a garden and all that, but this is a time when all the juices get flowing. The sap's rising, our sap is rising. Everybody is just rising to the occasion of the new light and the warming weather and things opening up again to another season of growth and wonder.
And there we had that magnificent full moon last night. I don't know if you got to see that. It was all the way up until this morning, right?
It was spectacular indeed, yes.
Super bright and just a happy, kind of joyful feeling around that, and so great to see as we head into Easter weekend. Well, Pat, you've got some words of wisdom to end for us here today, or anything else you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I guess actually, you know, the what you just mentioned, the large moon, you know, has me just reminding me about, you know, how completely it is all connected, you know. And indeed, I thought, you know, yeah, that full moon, I should just pay it, go take a look at the crops we have in the greenhouses. I'll bet you anything that there'll be a jump, you know. And I've spoken of that before. That's not uncommon that we get a jump in growth with a full moon. And it's wonderful to reflect on that and to understand that the influences, the pieces that make a garden are so many. And sometimes those influences are quite subtle. And yet it is that whole that makes the wonder of it, you know. And it's a great place, you know, for a little bit of reflection for it. And that's probably the spiritual aspect of it, you know. And that's interesting to me because I've, you know, having been, you know, I say a victim of, you know, Catholic school. Not to say that all Catholic schools are like that, but the Catholic schools I went to were not good at helping people to open up their spirituality. They were real caught up in rote memorization of doctrine and a lot of repression of the life force. And so when I left Catholic school, I had not much interest in the spiritual, in my own spirituality. And nothing has done more to allow me to open up to the innate spirituality we all have than being in the garden, you know. And you know, before I even knew it was happening, I used to be a paper boy with the full moon, and I would get up early and be delivering papers with the full moon. And the power of that was so incredible. You know, I was so powerful. I didn't get that I was having spiritual experiences, but I was way more connected to the world and just enthralled with it as I delivered those newspapers to moons like we had last night, you know, with the wind blowing and the tree branches swaying in that moonlight. And I just hope everybody has a moment, you know, in this spring where they get to experience all of it, you know, all the connections, all the wonder of it, and they realize that every last bit of that is why they have such a wonderful garden.
And a better quality of life, it happens in the process. It's really wonderful.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much, Pat. I can't wait to see you tomorrow. The soups and small plates, I've had several people mention they were very interested in attending that. So we'll be down at the French Broad Food Co-op with Meredith Lee and Pat Battle doing some really creative and delicious ideas for those little spring get-togethers and gatherings. Of course, spring, a great time to get back out of that that winter cave and get out there and have fun and have lunches and brunches and gatherings. So we look very much forward to that tomorrow evening. And
Absolutely.
Then the whole year of workshop schedules lined up for you to be a part of. So get on over to livingwebfarms.org, get registered, and we look forward to seeing you all year long and
Absolutely.
Talking to you again next
yep.
week.
Okay. I look forward to it, and I'll see you tomorrow night.
All right. Great. Bye-bye. That is Patrick Battle, This Week in the Garden, where we get perfectly good insights on what we can be doing, the wise ways that we can be making our gardens grow even better and uplifting our spirit in the process. Great to be here with you. Lisa Almaraz closing up Earth Heart Network Radio, the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Edition. We'll talk to you again next week right here.